According to his power that is at work within us.
Welcome to our episode covering the dangers of confined spaces, where we consider the lessons learned from one of the worst confined space catastrophes in U.S. history, involving the deaths of five workers in Colorado. I am your host, David Griffith, and our two guests have over 70 years combined experience related to today's discussion. Our guests are Jerome Speer and Bonnie Lockhart. Both of our guests have served as the chair of the Confined Spaces Committee in the American Industrial Hygiene Association. Jerome has been a guest of the podcast before, and he is the author of numerous articles while serving as the president and founding partner of Speer & Lancaster. Bonnie Lockhart is a certified industrial hygienist with valuable experience in the aerospace, automotive, and electric utility industries. Bonnie has also worked as an industrial hygienist with OSHA. Jerome and Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for the introduction, Dave. And Bonnie, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about this topic. So appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to join you both.
Great. All right. So today we're discussing the Cabin Creek tragedy, where two companies were involved, the painting company RPI Coating and XL Energy. This incident resulted in RPI having 25 serious OSHA violations with 13 willful, and XL Energy having 19 serious violations with 2 willful. So Bonnie, how would you describe the location of this tragedy?
Yes, this accident occurred at a pumped storage hydroelectric plant that was located up in the Rockies near Denver, Colorado, probably about an hour away. And so what is a pumped storage hydroelectric plant? Basically, what those types of hydroelectric plants do is they have stored water at the top of a mountain, and then a pipe is or a tunnel is drilled out in that mountain, and the water flows through it, at which point it enters the plant, spins a turbine, which then is connected to a generator, and it generates power. That water then leaves the plant and collects in a lower reservoir, or looks like a small lake. And then the water is pumped back up. These hydroelectric plants will provide extra power during peak periods. And generally the water is pumped back up during low use periods of electricity, such as during the night. So this, so the upper reservoir, think of it like a bathtub, a large bathtub that has a drain in it. And so when they open up that drain, the water will flow through that tunnel or the pipe into all the way down through the mountain into the turbine at the power plant to make electricity. And the XL Energy was notified that their coating on the metal inside of this pipe was deteriorating. And in the industry, that pipe is called a penstock. So this penstock had a metal structure that was coated with epoxy, and that epoxy was coming off. And so they were going to replace that. And so basically that is the setting of this construction activity that was going to occur.
Great. Yes. So the penstock is like a tube. And so I believe there was 10 people involved in painting this. Like you were saying, they needed to recoat it. And so the 10 went in with the equipment, everything. So then what happened that led to the tragic loss of life of five of the crew?
So the contractors went in to you know, recoat. They had first sandblasted, and they had had some problems with carbon monoxide levels inside of that penstock. So that should have been an indication that maybe things weren't being controlled properly. When they were finished with their abrasive blasting and any kind of touch-up welding that they needed to do, they brought in their sprayer, their two-part epoxy, and they also brought in methyl ethyl ketone, which is a highly flammable solvent. In the industry, in the painting industry, they generally like to use the methyl ethyl ketone because it does have a higher IDLH level of 3,000 versus 3,000 parts per million versus some of the other solvents that you might have that you might use in the painting industry, such as xylene, which has a much lower IDLH level. IDLH means immediately dangerous to life or health. Title implies, it can cause death or irreversible health effects after a short period of time.
Or the IDLH level could be based on the flammability, which is the case for methyl ethyl ketone, right?
It can be. To my knowledge, that's not the case for methyl ethyl ketone. But you're right. Sometimes it is, like ethanol. The IDLH, or the 10% of the LEL, is lower than the IDLH for ethanol.
Or like acetone would be as well. That's a flammability hazard. So yeah, so you got to take a look at both of those issues, right? The health effects and potential flammabilities, which that's the problem with the MEK in this case, was the extremely low flash point, which is the temperature at which flammable vapors will be created. So, and I think that's one of the issues here that happened here, as far as the temperature that they were working in using MEK, which has an extremely low flash point, which is creating flammable vapors. So solvent choices, I mean, there's several factors. This is a case study that is, you know, essentially what could go wrong went wrong that resulted in the death of five workers. And that's one of the issues, is the need to flush the equipment because the paint started hardening up, you know, and they had to stop frequently to flush out the lines with the solvent. And in this case, they used MEK.
So there's so many issues to sort out here in the tragedy. We had 10 workers, five got trapped and remained in communication for 45 minutes. And we had this fire where they just could not escape the tube, but another five, I think it was, that were able to escape. So we've got a lot of stuff going on. We've got the evaporation rate of the solvent, the ventilation concerns, a lot of different things that contributed to the single in and out. A lot of different areas of problem, many areas of failure. Let's talk about the reasons and the different factors and how it contributed to the tragedy, how it contributed to what went wrong, because there's so many to sort out, and both of you are, you know, firmly aware of all these factors, and so it's kind of hard to know where to start, but there's so many. But it's a fascinating story.
Can we just back up 1 minute? Okay, I'm sorry. I may have interrupted a little bit prematurely, because we need to really kind of explain what exactly happened. Okay, so during the flushing out of the equipment, then there was a fire that erupted, and five workers were trapped, were blocked from exiting. There's only one exit in this penstock that was like 1,400 feet away from where they were working at. Two escaped and were able to exit. Five were not able to get past the fire and ran the opposite way towards the upper reservoir. And essentially they survived for like 45 minutes before they succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. All five were found dead once the rescue personnel could get into the penstock and recover the bodies at that point.
Right. So, I mean, there's even the rescue failure and the lack of training. So, I mean, it is a fascinating story that had me on the edge of my seat, like any thriller, any kind of, as it was broken down. So there's just so many areas of failure. So let's backtrack with that clarification. Let's backtrack to, more of the features that led to this fire erupting and the eventual loss of life.
So one of the things that I didn't mention was this penstock is walkable up to a certain point, then it's too steep to be able to exit. So as I mentioned, there's a upper reservoir, and the penstock as it exits or basically is the drain for that upper reservoir. It's too steep for the for anybody to be able to climb it without some sort of climbing device, ropes, some sort of climbing equipment. So they were applying the two-part epoxy at the lower part of the penstock. And so that left them with only one means of exit. As Jerome mentioned, they were over 1,400 feet away from that exit. So when they were applying this two-part epoxy, they started having problems with quality. They were seeing ridges and things like that. They were having quality issues with the paint adhering. So then they would have to clean out that spray line so that the two-part epoxy wouldn't harden in there and basically make their equipment useless. In order to clear that out, they had to spray the methyl of the ketone. Now, one problem that they used is they brought all of this methyl of the ketone in, and I believe it was about maybe 10 gallons total that they had in there. But they brought it in inside of the penstock in open pails instead of using flammable safety cans. In addition, they didn't spray into any kind of safety container, closed safety container. So when they would try to reapply, they had the same problems. They had to spray it out again. And then when they were spraying with the methyl ethyl ketone, which they had poured into this hopper that they had used for the two-part epoxy, and they were also using that to add a little methyl ethyl ketone to the two-part epoxy, there was a flash fire. Now, where this mixing station was set up is it was in between where they were spraying and the exit. So when the flash fire occurred, workers who were on the side and the exit side of the this mixing station were able to escape. I believe a total of four were able to run out. On the spraying setup side of this mixing station, which was closer to the upper reservoir, the area that you cannot exit, there were five workers. They ran away from the flames instead of trying to run through the flames. And as mentioned earlier, they waited for help and they were in communication using their radios. So the problem that they had was they started this job in September. And as you can imagine, in the mountains of Colorado, and that's when they started abrasive blasting. But it wasn't until October when they were able to paint. They had to wait until that abrasive blasting was done. The two-part epoxy, there's a couple of challenges that they encountered. One, inside that penstock, it's cool. It's normally cool, but the temperature of the earth, as you can imagine. which created a challenge considering the technical data sheet for the two-part epoxy indicated that there were some challenges with that using it at that temperature. So the temperature of the wall and the air temperature would create challenges. The other problem is it would be even cooler, you know, when you're trying to ventilate and keep those airborne concentrations down. And now they began that painting in October. So both of those created the challenges and set the stage.
Well, not only that, they were actually staging gallons of paint inside the penstock, which is below the recommended temperature for storing the paint, which contributed to the problems that they were having as well. So yeah, it was cold. It was cooler than the operating temperature of the paint application, essentially.
So what I'm hearing is that the paint components and the surface were too cold for ideal application, and so they ran into trouble. Is that correct?
Right.
All right. So I think we're gonna continue here talking about the storage of the solvent was a problem. What about the flammable atmosphere? Just were they sampling? Were they, you know, how did they maintain a safe or how did they fail to maintain a safe working environment? Were they sampling the air? You know, could they have seen some indicators sooner?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the problems was that they were, or two critical problems in my viewpoint, is their fire extinguisher was not in the area where they were using and storing flammables. They had that outside the penstock at the entrance, which was over 1,400 feet away from where the fire started. The other problem was they were performing air sampling, but their attendant was sampling at the entrance. So they didn't have any four-gas instruments located inside the penstock next to where they were spraying the two-part epoxy, nor next to this mixing station. Had they done any of those three things, had they had a fire extinguisher, they might have been able to quickly put it out so that it didn't ignite all of the other stored two-part epoxy components that was located inside the penstock. And obviously, if they had the four gas instruments, it would have alarmed, notifying them that they've exceeded 10% of the lower explosive limit inside the penstock. Now, it's unknown. I didn't see anything in the Chemical Safety Board's report that indicated why they sampled that far away. Was it insufficient training, or was it something that they did as a practice so that they didn't have an alarm that would shut down their operation? Now, the report did say that they had to shut down the operation earlier during the abrasive blasting due to carbon monoxide levels. They apparently used some carts and equipment that generated some carbon monoxide. They had done some welding as well. And so they had to shut it down due to carbon monoxide levels being too high. It didn't say where they were sampling, though, whether that was outside the penstock or if during that time they were sampling inside. That part I do not know. But the practice of sampling over 1,400 feet away from the area where the flammable atmosphere is being generated is a dangerous practice. That would be like if you smelled natural gas in your house and you call the fire department and they go 1,400 feet away to try to sample. That's just not capturing where the hazard is. and it's not going to capture the highest concentration.
The other factors are that penstocks are unique and very difficult to ventilate, and that goes into the flammable environment, you know, which the components of whether or not you're going to have a flammable environment is the generation rate. First, the flammability of the material, of the vapors, and the generation rate, which they were pumping MEK through the lines steady, you know, to flush out the lines. So you had a high generation rate, and you have the ventilation rate, you know, was insufficient, obviously, to have a flammable atmosphere. So, and then that's why it's so critical to have a monitor in a confined space such as this during a dangerous, you know, high risk operation, you know, close to the work activities. And as far as the fire extinguisher, it may or may not be able to be suitable to ignite the fire, but at least it would give them a fighting chance to extinguish and knock down the flames to get past, you know, the sprayer where the fire erupted, so they could escape.
Right. Wow. Go ahead, Vaughn.
I was just going to add that it might have knocked down the fire enough for the five workers to be able to run by that mixing station, that mixing platform, and exit the space.
Right. Wow, there's so many confined space considerations in this Cabin Creek catastrophe. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. Spear and Lancaster is an expert safety, process safety, and industrial hygiene consulting firm dedicated to helping organizations increase profits using risk management and incident prevention techniques. Spear and Lancaster has over 60 years of combined experience assisting hundreds of national and international organizations in achieving greater profitability by reducing workplace risks. Welcome back to our episode covering the dangers of confined spaces, where we are discussing one of the worst confined space catastrophes in U.S. history involving the death of five workers in Colorado. So there's a little more to cover on the scene as we continue. What else was there in terms of, you know, we had this fire, but what led to the ignition of this fire? And then the rescue response as they went up the upper reservoir side of the penstock, you know, they were not able to rescue them. So what broke down in this tragedy in those kind of areas?
Bonnie, you want to take that?
Sure. The CSB looked at several different possible ignition sources, and they settled on static ignition because RPI was not using conductive hoses. They did not properly bond and ground the spraying and mixing setup. They also looked at some reports by the workers who stated that there were some problems with basically the power distribution center. They were having some problems, and one of the RPI workers, who was not a licensed electrician, basically did some wiring to get it to work properly. But in doing so, the individual had used a 3 rather than a 4 prong connector, and CSB's assessment stated that as a result, no ground connection in the circuit. And the sprayer was utilized because of how that was set up. They also had halogen lights that weren't designed for a flammable atmosphere. So they looked at that as a possible ignition source.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I was just going to mention another thing that they looked at was possible ignition due to auto ignition of heating the MEK vapor. There was some, you know, the 300 watt halogen bulb that could have been a potential for auto ignition temperatures for causing the MEK to ignite. Hot surfaces on the sprayer equipment. So there's several different things that could have been the ignition source for this, for the methyl of the ketone. But CSB, after their full research, believed that it was due to static electricity.
Right, as the most probable cause. Based on the witness report, that's where they, the one of them that escaped, observed that's the origin of the flash fire at the base of the base of the hopper of the base component. And they also didn't find any of the hoses remaining from that base hopper, whereas they did, indicating that it was a non-conductive hose, where they did find some metal remnants hoses of the hardener hopper side. And so the two ignition sources that they could not rule out as a possibility, but less likely, was the heat from the non-explosion proof lighting, the halogen lamps that Bonnie mentioned, as a possible source, but not probable or not as likely. And then also stray current flowing through the hopper was another source that they could not rule out.
Interesting. So as they were trapped, not able to run through the fire, because we've heard about the distant fire extinguisher and different factors, single exit on the low side of the penstock, five workers trapped by the fire engulfing the tube. What about the inability to rescue those five as they called in local resources? What could have gone different?
Planning. I'll say first thing is planning and training. That'll be the first step. But go ahead, Bonnie.
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you have that type of a risk, they had the hazard of, they had the atmospheric hazard that could have generated an ideal age atmosphere and or a flash fire. We saw the flash fire, but either of those required that they have to have a rescue team. And that rescue team has to be, OSHA is, does not specify the amount of time. It's based on the hazards. And based on these hazards, they needed a rescue team that needed to be on site. And when they called, first of all, the individuals that were able to escape had to run over 1,400 feet in order to notify somebody that they needed help. So that's a little bit of a distance. That one grabbed a fire extinguisher. They tried coming back and putting it out, but by then, the epoxy containers had ignited, and they weren't able to reach the fire at that point. They did try. Once they were able to notify XL Energy, so they let the control room know what was going on, XL Energy had called 911 asking for assistance. That assistance, if I remember correctly, came within 15 minutes, but those individuals did not have the skills to be able to go inside of a permit-required confined space to perform rescue. So they called in their special unit who performs and trains for these types of rescues. And it took them, and I'll help me with the time on that, Jerome. I think it took over an hour for them to be able to get there.
It was like an hour and 15 minutes, if I recall. The closest skilled, trained rescue service or team. That's totally inadequate. I mean, for this particular case, site or find space, they need to be on site, train people with the equipment, fully equipped, enabled to do an entry rescue or a non-entry rescue, but I think it'd be pretty hard to do a non-entry rescue in this particular case. But and that's one of the uniqueness of penstocks, because you typically do have very limited means of egress. It's not unusual for much of the penstock to be underground as well. And just to configure, you usually have steep slopes whether it be, you know, in part of the penstock or the pipe leg, or at a trifurcation where it branches off, and you have usually have steep slopes there too. So all of this stuff, it needs to be planned well in advance on what people are going to be on site to do the rescue, what equipment are you going to need, what can happen. And in a situation like this also, you know, there's some things that could have easily been done that would have at least mitigate or gave them a chance to rescue if an event happened. For instance, you could stage the sprayer in any paint or solvents in the penstock upstream. In other words, if a fire did erupt there, then the fire would not block the only exit to the penstock.
Interesting. Yes. So,
yeah, they should have had the mixing platform, which is where the fire started upstream. They didn't need to store all of that product inside. And right. As Jerome said, that what they did need to store, that should have been upstream of where the spraying operation was, so it didn't trap workers.
So we've covered so many great, you know, factors, insights, reasons. I've read a lot of Jerome's articles, and I've taken away that the best way to avoid tragedies and lawsuits is to prevent an accident. So how can we step back to the idea of contractor management and what went wrong there in terms of, you know, contractor selection, contractor safety performance? How would we break down this situation on that consideration?
Well, I mean, XL did play a role in this because it starts with XL or the premises owner to decide who to hire, and they decided to hire RPI Coating, which had a very poor safety record to begin with, which should have disqualified them from getting the project. But in fact, OSHA came when they did their investigation. They cited not only RPI Coatings for various confined space violations, but also XL Energy, and both were criminally indicted as well. So there could be some criminal implications for industrial accidents, as in this case. It doesn't happen very often, but occasionally it does happen. But from a premises owner standpoint, for managing contractors' performance on the site, it starts with a robust multidisciplinary contractor pre-qualification and selection process. That's where they evaluate their past performance, whether it be safety performance, fatalities, OSHA violations, quality issues, technical capabilities, qualifications of personnel who will be performing the job, past experience, things like that. And then they select it not only on cost, but should be on all these other factors as well. So that starts there. And then, you know, the second part is to incorporate health and safety requirements and contract documents. Now, this incident happened in October 2007. And at the time, OSHA had a permit required confined space standard for general industry, but did not cover construction sites. Now, today, there is an OSHA confined space standard for construction sites. Help refresh me, Bonnie. That was promulgated, 2015, right? So this is before they had a construction and confined spaces standard. And an issue of merely repainting an existing structure, it may not always be cut and dry if that's considered to be a general industry work site or a construction activity. It depends on if there's alterations or modifications to the structure. And if repainting, it gets to be even more gray areas as far as the complexity of the project can be a factor and all that stuff. And that's a whole nother topic. But the point is that something like that should be determined by the premises owner during the pre-contract phase. What standards apply? Are there any special site-specific standards and requirements that the customer has that they want the contractor to comply with. So all that stuff needs to be decided in advance. So you got pre-qualifications, contractor selections, incorporating health and safety requirements and contract documents. The third is their involvement in designing, preventing actions through design and planning. And we talked about that in regards to evaluating the confined space and the ability to rescue in the event that we need to extract somebody or entrance because of an emergency. Those are just some examples. Or how can we even prevent work in a high-risk, you know, environment to begin with? Can we design it out of the project? So those are some things to consider not only the pre-contract, but the planning phase after the contract signed, but they're planning, you know, with the contractor. And then once you have that established during the work in process, is there the premises owner, how involved are they in monitoring the contractor to determine that they're complying with the contractual provisions? Now, there was a third-party inspector on site, but mostly just for quality purposes. They may have had some, you know, maybe you can comment on that, Bonnie, as far as KTA Tater was third-party inspector on this particular project. And mostly it was a quality person, it was not a safety person. And I don't recall CSB. I think they commented on that, but I don't recall exactly. I don't think there was any sort of safety oversight that they provided of any much detail.
There didn't seem to be. It seemed like initially they were, you know, reviewing the proposals from the different bidders. I found it interesting, though. I mean, I'd be curious if they had questions about the temperature.
Yeah, right. And so the last thing as far as contractor management would be, once a project is complete, is there a process to evaluate the performance of that contractor? And this, again, it's not a safety function solely. It's a multi-team approach. And so they jointly evaluate the performance of the contractor and provide feedback to the contractor and ultimately determine if they're going to remain on as an approved vendor, you know, for future work.
Great. So we just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to take a step back and just look at the industry from a 30,000-foot view. This tragedy was in 2007. Yet a 2020 report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that over 1,000 workers died in confined spaces from 2011 to 2018. What have we learned from tragedies like this, and are we improving the ability to assess risk and plan work in confined spaces?
It's disappointing to me that we still see those high numbers. I do want to say, though, since the first standard came out, which was in 1993 for general industry, technology has gotten better. Back in 1993, when you wanted to sample a confined space, you'd have to get a separate LEL meter, a separate oxygen meter, separate carbon monoxide meter or carbon monoxide detector tubes. They're making these instruments smaller, lighter, and able to sample more things simultaneously. It is fantastic. Now, this technology was available for this project, but wasn't used where it should have been used. Retrieval devices are also much more advanced than they were back in when the OSHA standard came out in 93. So from that perspective, I think things have gotten better. Manufacturers of these safety equipment are really continuously developing things to make these activities safer, if only people use them and use them properly. I don't know if it's people not believing that it can happen to them or if it's just not, we're not training people properly. One of the report items addressed by CSB is that they found that XL Energy did bring in a union trainer to train because they felt there were some deficiencies. And not all the RPI employees attended, though. So the other thing is, it's also my understanding that some of these individuals, English was a second language. And so perhaps training wasn't as understandable for them. OSHA does require that you provide not only training, but training in a language that the workers can understand. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Jerome.
Yeah, my thoughts are that it doesn't appear that we're getting better as far as the number of fatalities from confined space work. Doesn't seem that like we're increasing, and it's hard to say, or decreasing. We may be increasing, but it's hard to say. I haven't analyzed it, but I don't know. But I do say, oftentimes confined space, when you have there's no room for errors when you work in a confined space. This is, oftentimes it can result in multiple deaths. And a lot of times I would say maybe up to 50% or maybe more than 50% of those who die in confined spaces are would-be rescuers. And I think we still have a long way to go to implementing rescue plans and having the equipment available and train people on site, or at least rarely available to respond timely. And usually we're talking about within minutes, somebody needs to respond and extract somebody, rescue somebody typically. But that's why from reviewing programs and sites involving confined spaces, I would say that's one of the most frequent violations I would find. And you were a compliance officer, Bonnie, and I don't know, maybe you have some comments on the confined space or the rescue aspects of confined spaces.
Yes. One other thing I did, all those are good points. I did want to add to that something that was a challenge that for this particular penstock at the drain portion that's in the quote bathtub or the upper reservoir, they had like this mushroom is what they called it, but basically like a 40-foot tall cap over that drain. Workers did try to drop SCBAs and hope that it would slide down and reach the workers, and they did find it nearby, but it's very dark in the penstock. And there's no, it would be very difficult to be able to see that, much less try to use it if you've never used it before in your life. It was a good try, but what they could have done was have something set up where they could have exited from that location. It would have been more difficult and challenging, especially with that cap that they have, but they could have removed, there looked like there was like a metal screen that covered the openings. It was like a 20-foot opening is how it was described in the CSB report, but perhaps they could have removed one of those and had something set up so that they could retrieve people in the event of some sort of emergency. But if they had a rescue team that's familiar with rope rescues set up at that location, that would have been another thing that would have been important for this, to prevent this tragedy. They might have been able to get everybody out as well. But as you, as was discussed earlier, it's all about prevention. Once you have to implement your rescue plan, you better make sure you have good rescuers and people who train and know it like the back of their hand whenever you're talking about a serious situation like this.
So many lessons to learn from this Cabin Creek tragedy. I want to thank our expert guests, Jerome Spear and Bonnie Lockhart, for their valuable information. I want to thank all the listeners for joining us. And until next time, so long.
According to his power that is at work within us.
To him